Hello and welcome to the Blockade Runner podcast number 244. My name is John. Joining me today is Ryan. What's up, Ryan?
Hello. Hi, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Ryan. You know, you texted me a few days ago. You told me that this was maybe your favorite episode of The Mandalorian ever. So I'm wondering, are you a convert to The Mandalorian, Ryan?
You know, I watched it again, the episode again today, which is not something I typically do, just with the, you know, amount of Star Wars television that's out there. I watched it again today, and I gotta say, this is an absolutely phenomenal episode. I may have been a little hasty saying that it was my favorite episode of The Mandalorian, but it might be. I don't know. It's just an excellent piece of Star Wars television.
Okay. Yeah, great. I was so excited about, you know, asking you, are you a convert now to The Mandalorian? Mm. I didn't even mention that in this episode of the Blockade Runner podcast, number 244, we will primarily, or maybe only, be discussing The Mandalorian chapter 19, 18. The Convert. The episode called The Convert. So that one aired a few days ago, and we are going to focus on that for today's episode. So, I also thought this episode was great. Really, really good. You know, certainly a different flavor for this show, which at least a big chunk of it was, and that may be part of why you responded so strongly to it, Ryan. But yeah, I think it was really good. I don't want every episode of The Mandalorian to be like this, really, but I thought it was...
Okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I would be too, but you know, I think part of what makes it so successful is that it is kind of a surprise and a change of pace and, you know, something that I think will be really important to the story of this show, but you know, not like all of a sudden that this is what this show is now, you know, but I think it's something that, is going to go a long way to, you know, making this season's story or plot or whatever kind of work. So.
Yeah. I think like just kind of like the mission statement of this episode. I think with its, mostly singular focus, and then also just like, you know, just kind of a, hey, this show can also do this. It was just really cool. Because like, yeah, I mean, when I started watching the episode on Wednesday morning, like you watch like the first part and you're like, yep, this is an episode of The Mandalorian. And like, then all of a sudden you're like, huh? Oh, interesting. We get to catch up with this character for a little bit. And then you're like, oh, that's what this episode is.
Yeah. Like,
that's pretty cool. Yeah, a lot of really compelling ideas in this episode. Stuff that's, you know, it felt weighty and important on like both macro and micro levels. And before we start like going into like the episode more deeply, I do just want to shout out that this episode was directed by another first-time Star Wars director, Lee Isaac Chung, who most recently directed the very acclaimed film Minari pretty recently. And, you know, I do just want to say that, like, it has been awesome, you know, for the past two episodes of The Mandalorian to have like these kind of like fresh, like new to Star Wars directors coming in, because I think, you know, both the past two episodes have been excellent. And, you know, I do think it's also like Disney and Lucasfilm kind of like putting their money where their mouth is, and actually delivering on like diverse creators in Star Wars, just kind of like across the board. And, you know, kind of moving it away from this, you know, just very like white male centric origin of it, to, you know, encapsulate a lot of different voices. And I think that's ultimately been a really good thing for keeping, you know, the stuff feeling fresh. So good on them.
Yeah, I meant to research the director a little bit before we started recording, did not do that. So I'm glad that you did. Have you seen Minari, Ryan? I haven't seen it, but...
I remember it being incredibly well reviewed when it came out, and I just have not actually seen it myself.
Yeah.
I would like more so now.
I think the other side of that is, the other side of what you're talking about with the new voices and creators coming in is like, wow, it's cool that a Star Wars show is attracting, you know, talent like that. I guess people who have made some highly acclaimed and critically acclaimed work and are kind of, you know, have some momentum behind them, some buzz behind them, like wanting to come in and do a Star Wars thing is kind of cool too. And Ryan, while we're handing out our flowers to creators involved in this episode, I'm sure you would not want to let this opportunity pass to give some credit to co-writer of this episode, Noah Clore, because almost all of these episodes of The Mandalorian are written by Jon Favreau. Like, he gets the credit for writing those episodes. So I was like, oh, you know, I as soon as the episode was done, I was like, hey, that was a really interesting episode. It's kind of a change of pace. I should look this writer up or I should look at the credits a little more closely. And I saw, oh, well, this one was co-written. So I looked that writer up, and his primary claim to fame is working on the Book of Boba Fett, as well as on this show, The Mandalorian with Jon Favreau. So
yeah,
got some of that good Book of Boba Fett, creative energy coming in too.
You know, it's nice to see people improving in their craft over time.
Maybe he was involved in some of the there were some great moments in the Book of Boba Fett, in my opinion, and he may have been involved in some of those great moments. And then I have some ideas about who may have been involved in some of the moments that, you know, I don't think were quite as strong in the Book of Boba Fett, but I like that show. I like the Book of Boba Fett. I'm just giving you the business because I know it's not your fave. So
no, I
just
don't
like it. Quipping a little bit here at the top of the show. All right. Yeah, So let's talk about the episode. I think, you know, before we get into it, like the whole thing with this episode, The Convert, right, is that it's like there's two portions of this episode. And so it's bookended in the beginning and the end with, you know, picking up with Din Djarin and Bo-Katan. And, you know, that stuff is, as you said, kind of expected, right? Still good stuff in there. And we'll talk about that for sure. But then the whole, you know, I would say like mainly like two thirds of the episode in the middle there is all about Dr. Pershing and the other character who in this episode is referred to by their, like just their code name or whatever, G, and there's some numbers afterwards, G68, I think.
G-62.
It's either G68 or G50. I think it's G68. I have G68 written down, so I think it's G68. Okay. So, I mean, you know, the bulk of the episode follows those two characters in the amnesty program, which we'll get all into that. But it's bookended by the story with Din and Bo-Katan. And I thought that was really surprising. I think it definitely kept me on my toes. You know, like I wasn't surprised by the opening, you know, sequence or portion of the show. But then as I was watching the Pershing section, you know, I didn't expect that, of course. And then the longer it went on, I was like, whoa, is this whole episode now from here on out going to be Pershing? You know, so then when it went back to Din and Bo-Katan, it was like kind of a surprise too, at that point, just because of how long it held on that one storyline. So, I just think like for the viewer, at least for me anyways, that experience was really cool. And kept me kind of guessing as what was going to happen next, and very intrigued in sort of the way the story was being told.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So do we want to talk about the Bo and, I guess we have a couple options. Do we want to talk about it in order and just talk about the beginning of the episode, the Pershing section, and then come back to, Din and Bo-Katan, or do we want to just talk about all the Bo and Din stuff?
I think sequentially actually works, because I know something that you've been kind of hammering in our text chat is like the convert is multiple people in this episode. Yeah. And I think like the ending sequence works better after watching the Pershing stuff. I think it's like just a really, really well thought out the way the episode plays out.
Okay. All right, cool. I don't know if I hammer, but all right, let's kind of go sequentially.
You
then.
You brought it up multiple times.
All right, let's go sequentially. So yeah. The episode opens up, just like picks up like cold open, like right where it left off last week. In that, you know, in the minds of Mandalore, Din and Bo still got some living waters dripping off of them as they're sitting there. And it's really interesting. I mean, I think the first line that Din says is, "I am redeemed." You know, he's like, yeah. "It happened," because he wakes up and he's like, "I'm redeemed. I did my thing. I did the thing I've been waiting to do." Yeah. So that was cool. And then, you know, from there, Bo and Din have this conversation where you can tell that Bo-Katan is like kind of feeling things out. You know, did I see what I think I saw? You know what I mean? Did you see anything down there? That whole thing. So
living.
Yeah. So her kind of like being unsure, I think was great, because I suppose it does add a little ambiguity, at least at this point, as to whether or not there really was a mythosaur down there, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like there was. What do you think about that? Do you think there was a mythosaur down there, or?
I don't know. Like, you know, in the last episode, I was like, okay, she saw the thing that, like, dudes have tattoos of. Like, whatever. Like, and then, I didn't really care. I was like, okay, well, maybe there's, like, some weird, like, underwater dinosaur down there. Whatever. Like, and then like this episode, I think with both this section and then like the way the episode ends, like, I don't know, it like added some weight to it, and it like kind of made me care a little bit more. And I think the like ambiguity around it like actually helps. Like, did she see like a vision, or like is this like thing actually down there? And like, if what happens when other people see it, if it is actually down there, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know. It's cool.
Yeah, I think whether she saw it or not, or whether I should say whether it's really down there or not, either way, like asking the question, I think further emphasizes or highlights the mythical significance of it, because it's like, it's a thing that's so, you know, weighty and so spiritual and so important to her that she's like not even sure if she really saw it or not, you know? So, I have a feeling that question will be answered, as the show proceeds, but you know, maybe not. Maybe they never go back to the minds of Mandalore, and maybe, you know, there's no occasion for that mythosaur to reveal itself as being real or not. And, you know, that would be just as good, or maybe better potentially, if they leave it kind of ambiguous. But I guess last week I was like, well, I feel like we're going to get an answer, and I still feel like we will get an answer, or we will, you know, kind of end up seeing it. But to me, the real weight and joy of it is not in the creature itself, but more just the way it's exploring the power of myth, you know, through that symbol of the mythosaur.
Like a very not subtle way, because it is literally called Mythosaur.
Well, that's true. Yes, that is true. Although that, I mean, the name precedes like what they're doing with it now, I think, don't you?
Yeah,
I don't know.
But the, yeah, like it was kind of this ridiculous, campy thing, you know, it before, and now, I don't know, like it's that cool thing that Star Wars does sometimes, when it takes something that's like super dumb and like really on the nose and like kind of embarrassing, and then like makes you be like, this is this is really important. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's cool.
Yeah, because it's all about what it means to these people. You know what I mean? So the thing it is itself doesn't matter that much once, you know, if they can make me believe and care about what it means to this culture and these characters and these people, then like the thing itself could be anything. You know what I mean? It's about the power of what it means to them, I feel like. So, and they've done a pretty good job with that, obviously. Yeah. Cause we've said this many times, or at least I have, like, you know, I went into this show being pretty uninterested in the idea of Mandalorians and Mandalorian culture and stuff. You know, it just, not like I hated it or anything, but it was pretty low down on my list of things that I was interested in Star Wars. And, I'm certainly much more so, you know, now, you know, so I think through the process of getting to know these characters, getting to know this culture, a little more, or kind of, you know, spending more time with it. And really just, I mean, spending all this time with this character of Din Djarin, who's really wrestling with what it means to be a Mandalorian and what, you know, the belief system and rites and rituals are of the Mandalorians. Like, I think that just has made me care about this stuff, you know? So I don't even think about the fact that it's sort of, in some ways, like that mythosaur symbol. I don't even know what I don't want to compare it to anything in the real world, I guess, but it's just it could be a little, not the most tasteful thing in Star Wars.
It's a Punisher skull.
That's actually the perfect, I was going to say truck nuts, and I was like, but that's not right. Yeah. They're not truck nuts, you know. Yeah. But if you have truck nuts, I could see you having a giant. See, this is what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to make this mean-spirited, rude, condescending, obnoxious. You know, I didn't want to go there.
Yeah.
So stop pushing me in that direction. Ryan, did you see when, did you catch the moment where Grogu was trying to say, this is the way? I swear he was trying to say, this is the way.
Yeah. I didn't really catch it the first time I watched it. And then over the course of the week, there's suddenly this like whole online conversation about like Grogu's first words, that was like kind of inspired by that moment. And then when I watched it again, I was like, oh yeah, he is like, he's like getting ready to talk.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that last week and I forgot to, or, you know, I didn't bring it up. And I think I posted in our Discord actually, which everybody listening should join. I think I posted in our Discord like, oh, I meant to talk about that on the show and I didn't, you know, but I think they were hinting at
it last week too.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Totally. I think Pelly even said like, she said something about his first words. Like, oh, did he talk? Or like, there was something, I can't remember what the line is now, but she definitely made a comment and I was like, And I just noticed he's cooing and making sounds and stuff a lot more, I think, than he had been in the past. So I feel like before season 3 is over, we might hear, I don't know. I think we're definitely on the way.
The way this is.
Yeah.
Is he gonna do that?
Well, the syntax is certainly a question. Yeah. Speaking of other things I caught that I loved, did you see did you pick up on, or do you agree that there was an homage to Batman 89 in this?
Is in my notes.
Okay. Yeah, mine too.
The N1 going up and like the Batwing over the moon.
Yeah.
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 Perfect.
I feel like that was really great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm not mad about that.
Okay, good. But you were a little mad last week about R5. So now my question is, did you enjoy R5 a little more this week? Because I felt he added to the dog fight, the space fight.
No. That's still just one of those things that I'm just like, just get him out of there. I just don't want to see him anymore. Like, it's a bad thing that just needs to go away.
Okay, because I didn't feel like there were any moments in this week's episode where they were like, this is the R5 you remember from before, right? He's just there now. And I enjoyed watching him like float in the, you know, like there was a scene where they were like, they lost gravity for whatever reason. I don't know how gravity works in Star Wars, but he was floating there for a minute, you know,
yeah.
And then he was getting knocked around a little bit, a la BB-8 in The Force Awakens, I guess.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that. So I also felt during this opening space battle, this dogfight or whatever you want to call it, I thought it continues to look incredible. Like, I think we're talking excellent visual effects, really ILM really killing it, bringing to what is to me like movie level, you know, special effects for this show. It's looking really, really good.
I would say for this section, that is true. I think there's some shots a little later that didn't quite work for me.
Are you thinking nighttime shots on Coruscant where... Okay.
Yeah. Okay. There's a few of those. And then, I mean, spoilers. The mind wiper effects are like pretty like... I don't know. Maybe it was supposed to look like something from like Flash Gordon or something, but it looked kind of corny. But but what I will say about this fight, so I have two video game references in my notes, and this is the first one. It reminded me a lot of a mission, and I can't remember which game it was from, if it was Star Wars Starfighter or the sequel Jedi Starfighter on PS2. I think it was Starfighter, but there's a it was definitely Starfighter, because you're flying a Naboo cruiser. So there's a scene that's like on kind of like a craggy like beach area over like a big body of water where you're like fighting some dudes in your Naboo cruiser, and made me think of that scene, which was a nice thing to think about because I like those games a lot. So fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. So that's the one. Was there another one, or you're saying it would remind you of both of those games, or?
No, we'll get to the other one in a bit.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay. So I guess as far as the remainder of that opening sequence goes, what I have here is just obviously, you know, Bo's home, her castle is bombed and destroyed there by the TIE bombers. You know, it was interesting seeing her reaction to that. Obviously she was upset by that, right? And I think you know, that's more compelling after she is forced to confront, like, maybe some of this Mandalorian stuff like matters to me more, or I believe in it more than I'm letting on, or, you know, like, she's her faith in or belief or like kind of devotion to the way of the Mandalore or whatever it is kind of reawakened in the previous episode, right? And then they're like, okay, but now we're taking away this, you know, this element or this, like, you know, physical part of your Mandalorian heritage or whatever. Like, so that stings, I would say, considerably more, you know, now that she's off of the couch and kind of, you know, getting involved again to see her home destroyed, I think is, you know, obviously that stings a little more.
Yeah. And it puts her in this like weird, kind of hero's journey moment as well, like, where, which is, you know, she's like an older character at this point, but you know, like we kind of saw with Obi-Wan, like, you know, you can still do like a hero's journey type story you know, later in life, it doesn't just have to be like, you know, a thing for like young people, but like it was like having her home, her sanctuary kind of destroyed, like puts her on, you know, it forces her into action, into like another, situation. And like, it takes away her kind of like complacency and self-loathing, that was happening, and kind of forces her to confront some other things. And, you know, I thought that was cool. It was, you know, similar, I guess, to, you know, what kind of pushed, you know, Luke into his journey was like having his homestead destroyed and like, you know, there's nothing for me here, kind of thing. And, you know, I think Rey was kind of like forced out of her home and that life into like this bigger thing. And that seems to be what's happening with Bo-Katan in a way.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. I mean, we'll see how it all shakes out. But I really like her being a primary character in like this season. I think, you know, obviously Katie Sackhoff is like an incredible actor. I've spoken at length about my love of the Battlestar Galactica reboot. It's probably my favorite TV show of all time. And she's amazing in that. And, you know, I do think she adds something to Din's story. And I hope that it's like, she's not just like dropped off on another planet, you know, in episode 4, and then we don't like see her again until like the end of the season, which, you know, you never know. But to me, I feel like both just plot wise and theme wise, she's like a super important character that like acts as like a really good foil for Din's story. So I hope that she is kind of like the second protagonist, and you know, we have, or I mean, I guess third, because I guess Grogu would be the second, but then that puts us in a situation where we have, you know, a trio, you know, the Luke, Han, and Leia, the, you know, Finn, Poe, and Rey, like having those like trios in Star Wars for protagonists. Like, I don't know, that also seems nice. But I think her story has gotten much, much more compelling with this episode in particular. And I would be kind of shocked if she wasn't, you know, right there for the rest of this season.
Yeah. I mean, we have mom, dad, and baby really is what we have, you know, with the three of them together there. You know, I'm not getting Luke, Han, and Leia vibes. I'm getting more like, you know, now it's mom and dad with a little baby Grogu. So, but we'll see how it all shakes out. But I mean, like, you know, the other thing that taking her home away does is like, it puts her in this position where like everybody else in her clan or her military or whatever it was left her. And now her home is destroyed too. So she's kind of an orphan, you know, over there with, the children of the watch and the armorer. I mean, we're kind of getting into like the end anyways, but the armorer tells her like, if you want to stay, you know, she actually doesn't even say that, like, you're one of us now, you know, until you take that helmet off, or until you leave, you're one of us. And so, she has to kind of, you know, sort of wrestle with that. Do I want to do that? Is this going to be my new identity? Am I willing to kind of like, do I actually want to consider maybe like that some of these things that this cult or whatever, this splinter group, this offshoot of Mandalorianism or whatever is doing, like, maybe do I want to be a part of that? And, so yeah, we'll see where it goes. I mean, I certainly think it could, you know, maybe her taking some tentative steps into that and then being like, no, this is weird. Like, this is not right. You know, could be a catalyst for Din to look at it through a fresh pair of eyes and be like, okay, yeah, maybe not, you know? So who knows? We'll see. As far as this scene goes, like, or this opening segment of the episode, the last thing of note that I have is, that Bo says that's a lot of ships for an Imperial warlord. And I thought that line was really, really intriguing because, you know, we don't have, so far in this season, there's not really like an established big antagonist like there has been in previous seasons, you know, and we don't really know what's going on with Moff Gideon. He was referenced, I believe, in this episode a couple times.
I think so we really don't know what's going on by the end of the episode.
That he's escaped, that he's no longer a prisoner or what?
No, I think he's still operating.
Okay.
But from prison.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah. But I wonder what that line means. Like, does that, 'cause wouldn't Moff Gideon is an Imperial warlord, right? So like the Bo-Katan is sort of saying, they're like, I don't know. Like, does Moff Gideon have this much firepower, you know? And at least that's how I interpreted it, or it's what it made me think of right away. And if it's like, if that's what she's saying, then, you know, I would guess the reason they're asking that question is because the answer is no, he doesn't. And if he doesn't, then who does, you know? So I'm wondering, like, if we are, you know, I'm very curious to see what's going to happen there. And I think obviously what goes on in the Dr. Pershing section of the episode certainly suggests that there are other forces operating out there, right? So this is one example of how these two kind of dueling storylines, or the dual storyline kind of in this episode, complement one another, because I think in both cases, you know, I'm sort of saying to myself, so wait, what's going on with the Empire? Like, what are they up to? You know? And it's asking some really interesting questions.
Yeah. I would say, if you are a person who is curious about maybe where this story is going, and I don't have any, this is just a gut feeling. It's a gut feeling and then also a pragmatic one, because it shouldn't be like too big of a surprise if it does happen. But I would say it might be time to reread the original Zahn books, Heir to the Empire.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking as well. But then the other part of me is like, I don't know. Like, I wonder, I expect to see him in Ahsoka. And so, you know, that doesn't mean he can't be in the season of The Mandalorian. He certainly could be, and that would be cool. But I'm curious if he's going to show up now or if he's going to show up later. But I do think, of course, he will show up, right? So,
yeah, meaning Thrawn. We're talking about.
Yes, Thrawn. Yes, sorry. Yeah. And it could just be that season three of The Mandalorian is going to be sort of planting those seeds, and maybe he shows up in the last episode, or, you know, maybe he's going to be like the big bad starting next week. I really don't know. But I do think that would make sense, right? That Thrawn would be part of the equation. So, yeah, I'm with you.
And now, like, it has been so, so long since I've read those books, and I, like, they're not really my favorite Star Wars in a lot of ways, and I don't know how it would be if I, like, reevaluated them, but it's been, like, 20 years, at least, since I've read those books. And I can't remember, is part of the story that because I know, like, there's a clone of Luke, and the Emperor gets cloned as well, right, in those books?
Well, here's the thing,
Ryan. Am I misremembering that?
I don't know if you are or not, because I've never read them.
Oh.
So you can go ahead and take my Star Wars podcasting card away.
Wow.
Post haste. Yeah, I've never read the Thrawn trilogy. I read one of the new Thrawn books, you know, but I haven't read the Thrawn trilogy. Yeah. So, I haven't read the other five of the new Thrawn books, if there's five of them or however many there are, but,
yeah.
So I don't know, but okay. Yes, I do believe the cloning of the Emperor was part of that whole thing. I guess it's like, it's hard to remember, like, what's in Dark Empire and what's in Heir to the Empire and what's in, you know, all that stuff. So,
yeah.
But plenty of talk of cloning in this episode. So I don't think, I think where there's smoke, there's fire, and that's probably a good thought on your part. Not that I expect to see the Emperor, but cloning and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely going to be like, if they do the story, it's not going to be a one-to-one.
Right, because when you first started to bring up the Thrawn, the Heir to the Empire trilogy or whatever it's called, I was going to be like, well, really? I mean, at this point, we should probably just look more to like Rebels and the newer books that that Timothy Zahn has written, because there's a lot of canon Thrawn content out there now.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, as you completed your thought, like, okay, well, you're wondering like if there's certain major plot points from that original series of books that they may be mining here. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say, if, you want to kind of like check out a version of the story, kind of an abridged version, and not like read three very hefty and verbose novels. There was a Dark Horse comic adaptation of the Heir to the Empire trilogy. I don't know if that's the proper term for the trilogy, the Zahn books, whatever. There was a comic adaptation, and if I remember correctly, like, it hits the major plot points, like, obviously doesn't go into too much detail, and there's like a bunch of stuff that's like skipped over, but like you can basically read the entire story in like 2 hours if you just mess with the comic adaptation. So something to consider.
Any chance that's on Marvel Unlimited?
Probably a good chance, I would assume. I also would assume that those trade paperbacks are like out of print now. I don't know if those have been brought back or collected, but and
in my experience, anytime I've been like, oh, I should look at a trade paperback of some Star Wars comics from the 90s or whatever, it's like, cool, yeah, if I want to spend $80 or whatever, you know, they're very expensive.
And if you want like the single issues, they're like $100 an issue anymore. Ridiculous. I think they should be, well, they're certainly available digitally somewhere.
Yeah, you can. Right. Yeah, you can buy them somewhere. I'm sure. Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, let's jump into talking more explicitly about this whole middle section of the episode, where Dr. Pershing gets his chance to shine. Right. So we kind of cut from this whole Din and Bo storyline to all of a sudden to Coruscant, and we're cruising around in a speeder through Coruscant with Dr. Pershing and watching him give a TED talk, a space TED talk, which was great. Right. So,
yeah.
You know, I think this episode does a really great job of setting up this whole post-Empire New Republic amnesty program for, you know, former Imperials without having any awkward or without having too much awkward, like, expository dialogue. I think it was actually really, really well done at, you know, world building and informing the audience about, like, sort of the temperature in the room regarding this amnesty program and what it is and all that stuff without ever having, you know, too heavy-handed of exposition. I thought it was really, dare I say, expertly crafted, really, really well written and really, really well done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just the way it like slowly kind of, you know, it just the way it slowly reveals these like pieces and like these different like tension points throughout the episode where you're like, oh, that's weird. Like, and you're like, I can see some flaws in this. And then you get to like the end and you're like, oh God, like, what are these people doing?
It's, and I think too, like, what I really like about it is even as the episode ends, it's like, I think I know what I should think about each of these players in this situation, but I'm not totally sure what I should think about them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the amnesty program itself is a fairly well-intentioned, but, you know, not well-planned and not, it was not put together by people who really understand human nature or people who really understand, like, you know, how to treat other people. And I think there's a couple sort of, you know, examples of that. So it's very bureaucratic. It's very, you know, somebody who did you use the word McKinsey consulting firm thing when you were describing it in our text chain? Like,
yeah, I mean, like, the best description I've seen is like neoliberalism.
I
think, but I am wondering, like, this definitely is something with, like, as with all things in Star Wars, with like a historical precedent. And it feels like something I'm familiar with or I should know about, but like I don't really know. Like, is it something that happened with like post World War II? With did was there something similar to this after World War II?
Ryan, we are in the exact same position here where I was like, okay, watching this and I'm like, oh yeah, this is like a thing from real life, but I don't know enough about history to know exactly what it's referencing. This is where we need Dave Ackerson to pop in and tell us, like, I'm sure he knows exactly what. Yeah, but I feel like you're right. I feel like this is, I mean, 100% there are real world analogs, right, to this, but I can't give you the details on what they are, so.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's like a post-war analog to it. And then there's also like a lot of things from like just like rehab programs for, you know, I think with like criminal justice system, but also like drug and alcohol rehab as well. Community service, like all of these different things that are like still happening like in our society. But I think like the stuff with like caseworkers, like it's very like parole like kind of vibes.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, so the first time I knew something was awry with this amnesty program, because it's a good idea, right? Like it's a, that is a noble concept, I think, right? You know, if you won the war, you know, like we should try to rehabilitate or, you know, reintegrate people into society, right? I mean, if we're talking just like in the world of Star Wars, you know, I mean, there was how many trillions of people in the Empire, millions of billions of people in the Empire? I don't know, a lot, right? So, you know, what do? You just, you can't lock them all up.
It's like unavoidable. Like you can't imprison them all. You can't kill them all. Like, especially if you're like, we're the good guys, like,
But the first time I knew that this episode and these writers wanted to tell us, like, this is not a good program or this is not working or whatever, was when Pershing walked down, you know, from his TED talk and like all these just really obnoxious, wealthy, out of touch, like they just want to like poke at him. You know what I mean? They want to like he's an exhibit in a museum that they're, you know what I mean? And they just want to like pat themselves on the back because, oh, you know, pat him on the head and pat themselves on the back and be like, you know, look at what good things we're doing, you know, which I think is probably unfortunately so often the case with like, you know, neoliberal or just like bureaucratic programs that are supposed to be helping people. But like how much of it is about the people at the top of the food chain just wanting to, you know, be able to point to some program and say, look at this good thing I did, you know, or actually maybe, you know, put a little money in somebody else's pocket by setting up this program. And like, really the primary thing they're worried about is not the people it's going to affect and how it's going to affect them, but, you know, what it's going to do for their career, their buddies or whatever else. Right. So that was the first moment where I was like, okay, like they're really thinking about this. It wasn't like a quick, like, oh, I know, like, after the, you know, Galactic War, we'll just have an amnesty program and it'll be cool because the New Republic's really nice, and so like they'll just do this nice thing, right? Like,
yeah,
that would have been the shallow way to do this, but they're not taking that approach.
Yeah, and I think kind of like what you were saying, like, yeah, it is like just like in real life, it's like, you know, a pat on the back for themselves. It's you know, just very public way of like letting people know how you feel or how you want people to perceive you. But it's also like desperately trying to maintain a status quo when there is like a big shakeup as well. And something I was thinking about in this episode is a book I enjoyed and I don't remember it terribly well, which is a shame because it's fairly recent, but Claudia Gray's Bloodline, which was, you know, kind of about the imperfections of the the New Republic. That was kind of like threaded in there, like, and that was like the first time, like, you know, Star Wars was like coming out and being like, yeah, like, you know, this gargantuan system of like oppression doesn't just end because like you chuck a dude down a well, like that doesn't,
yeah,
you know, fix this for like the whole galaxy. And you know, I think that's where we kind of first see it with like Senator Organa's like struggles to, you know, be heard, and like, you know, she's seeing these things that are like super off. And the, you know, the deceit, the secrecy, all this, you know, stuff that's happening. And she, it kind of just points out to us, like, as, you know, readers, viewers, whatever, that like, yeah, there are some problems here. And this system is very fragile right now, despite, you know, the easy answer of like, well, the Emperor's dead, so it's all fixed kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you made a great point when you mentioned the status quo, like maintaining the status quo, because like Pershing clearly is wildly talented, right? Really, really brilliant. And they don't want his talent. They don't want him to use his talent. They stick him at a desk. They have him pushing papers around, and they don't actually, because he's not one of them. You know what I mean? So you can give him a TED talk, and you can go on the HoloNet and tell everybody like how altruistic you are as a New Republic, and you're gonna really help out these old Imperial guys, even though they were really bad before. But you know what? We'll be nice and forgive them. But then you forgive them by, you know, stripping them of their identity, forcing them to live in like barracks or like dorms or whatever, and then you don't even really want to, you know, allow them to flourish or grow or put their talent to use, because like you said, you got to maintain that status quo, right? Like, no, the people who have the power, we're going to keep those people in power, and anybody else who, you know, is from the other side or whatever, like that's a threat to the status quo. That's a threat to the established equilibrium, and can't have that, right? So, you know, that you put a nice, you know, kind of veneer over it where it looks like we're doing something for someone else, but really it's another system of oppression, you know? And I think like, you know, you were saying about the mythology stuff earlier, like, well, it's not super subtle, right? I don't think it's super subtle when they're introducing themselves to one another and they have to use their basically TK numbers, right? They have to, they don't even have names. Like they're, oh, I'm G68 or whatever. It's like, okay, well, we're dehumanizing these people in a pretty obvious way. So,
yeah. And I think like another kind of flaw that we start to see in the New Republic is just the sheer wastefulness of things, where, you know, there's like a part where Pershing's like, wait, all these like materials can still be like used. I forget like what exactly he's referring to. But
yeah.
And then they're like, no, but they're from the bad guys. So like we just got to like destroy them because, you know, we just have so much prosperity, or we can't, because we know that, you know, during this time, as in all times within Star Wars, that you know, even going back to the original trilogy, the prequels, there's always been these, you know, they're not afraid to show poor people in Star Wars. Like that's who Luke is, you know, like then, you know, we see it with like Anakin in episode one, like we know that like throughout the galaxy, you know, there's the mid rim, and then there's like the outer rim, and you know, it's the series has never been like subtle about showing disparities in
class distinction
and
yeah.
income and stuff. Yeah. So like we know, like, so we know that exists. And then to see like the New Republic being like, hey, here's all this stuff that like could help people, but we're just gonna like destroy it or just like let it rot somewhere.
Yeah, well, and also one of the things that's super interesting about it is like, yeah, in the original trilogy, it was like, okay, look at all this disparity, you know, between power and privilege between classes. But you could always just look at the top and say, well, yeah, this is the Empire's fault, you know, but now the Empire's gone and we're seeing yep. the New Republic implement similar systems. So it's really, really intriguing on that level. Another example of that, a couple other examples of that I just want to touch on quickly. In the interest of time, the New Republic has established this anti-cloning here, you know, and I think, you know, obviously people like cloning is a complex issue. And, you know, I wouldn't normally say like, oh, well, they're anti-cloning, like how awful of them. But at the same time, the Bad Batch right now is really exploring like what it means to be a clone. And that's airing on Disney Plus on the same day of the week as this show is. And so in the Bad Batch, the Empire has come out as explicitly like shutting down cloning, not being open-minded to cloning whatsoever, throwing clones away like they don't matter. Yeah. So then to then like kind of go from one show to the other and be like, oh, well, this version of the New Republic, they don't want Pershing. They don't want to touch it. Like, nope, cloning. And they have laws established to be like cloning is not allowed in the New Republic, you know? And it's like, the new Empire looks a lot like the old Empire, you know what I mean? So it's hard not to draw that distinction. Another example is they go and they visit the mountain. Like it's the one natural piece of Coruscant that you can actually see and touch. Everything else is unnatural or, you know, like it's all man-made. It's all, I don't know if we go so far as to say it's all an illusion, but you know, considering they just walked by a magician played by Dean Cundey a moment before that, like maybe it is all just an illusion. Maybe it is all just a magic trick. And, you know, I don't know if that was really, that maybe wasn't an intention there. I don't know. But yeah, I just think there's a lot of examples in this episode where we're looking at things saying, huh, the New Republic, like it looks kind of good on the surface. But man, when you dig into it, there's a lot of issues with this this new government that replaced the Empire. And it seems like maybe it's kind of hard to be a galactic superpower without turning into the Empire, you know, at least to some degree.
Yeah. And whether we like it or not, we are in full cloning conversation for the foreseeable future in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Cloning is part of Star Wars right now. It is part of the current vision. It is, a core component of, yeah. Of everything now. And, from episode 9, I mean, the entire sequel trilogy, episode 8 and, it's mostly because 9 is where you see the Snoke vats. But yeah, that's, I guess, where like cloning comes to the forefront again. And yeah, it is going to be interesting what like eventually there's probably going to have to be a final statement on cloning. I don't know if it like will just be like a part of Star Wars and it's just going to continue. And then we're going to see like clones of old characters popping up. And I hope that's like not the case, but like, I feel like, I mean, it is like one of the major themes of like modern Star Wars right now. And so I do wonder what like the final declaration or statement on cloning will be, because like as we can kind of see, you know, like you were saying, like there's parallels to how the Empire was handling cloning, which is extremely disingenuous, because we know that like obviously they were still continuing cloning despite like their you know, they just didn't want anyone else to do it. Mm-hmm. And then like, is, and then it, like here, like we are empathizing with Pershing. We're like, let this dude clone. Like let the man clone, come on. Like, and which is weird, but then like, obviously that's all taken away from him at the end and likely back in the hands of the Empire. I don't like, I wouldn't say that definitively, but that seems to be the resolution at the end of this episode. So yeah, I do wonder like where they're going to go with it.
Okay. So let's talk about Pershing, right? Like the, I feel like we could talk about this episode for a long, long time. Like we could probably make a very long episode and I'm not going to be able to do like a super long episode. So I will say plot wise, like what happens, right? Like Pershing, Aliyah Kane, I think is her name, G68. She slowly wins over Pershing. She wins him over and gets, you know, shows him the faults of the New Republic and convinces him that she's going to help him continue his research, even though they don't want him to do that. They take this journey, they go to a broken down Star Destroyer, they steal the lab equipment, but then it turns out she was setting him up, right? That's like how it ends, is that it was a setup. Okay. And he gets arrested, and then they use this mind flayer thing on him. And the doctor just walks away and like leaves her there with the knobs. And she just does a spinal tap, turn the knob up to 11, just straight to 11, man. And so that's like where things end with him. But I think what I want to dig into here is, what do we think about Pershing? Because I feel like the way the episode is constructed and the way we follow this storyline, it really sets him up to be this like well-meaning guy who just wants to sort of make up for the evils of the Empire and the way he contributed to it, and feels like his research and his knowledge and his skill could be used for the good of all mankind, you know? And then we see how, because of this oppressive sort of system he's placed in by the New Republic, how his resolve is kind of slowly whittled down, and he's able to be sucked right back into working for the bad guys, for the Empire, whatever it is, right? But I don't know if that's really what's going on here or not, because I'm unsure of this whole situation. Like, I don't know what to think about it. You know, Steele Saunders, Ryan, who I know you are aware of and follow and stuff like that, he posted something really interesting a couple days ago, which I didn't think about when I was watching the episode, but there's like a tick that Dr. Pershing does. There's this thing he does where he goes like this to his ear or whatever.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back and watch the episode from, or episodes that he was in from season one, but I want to say he was even doing that then in season one. But Steele posited that perhaps it's a tell when he's lying. And I was like, oh, well, that is an interesting thought. That's a really interesting idea. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I thought that was a very interesting theory, you know? And yeah, I think this episode presents him, at least on the surface level, as being that guy who just really wants to do the right thing. He was always presented as kind of meek and like, oh no, you'll kill the baby. Don't kill. You know, he always sort of seemed like not really that bad of a guy anyway. And so I don't know where to land on him. Do you question him at all? Or do you take it at face value? Or what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, like when the episode first started and when he was like first talking, I immediately like jumped to like, and it's because of like that tick, like I noticed it like right away. Okay. And I was like, you're acting really shifty here, dude. Like, is this just like BS? And that was like my initial response. And then as the episode went on, I was like, oh no, he's a sympathetic character. Like I get his situation. Like I'm on board with him. But and then I didn't really ever like go back and like revisit those, that like initial first impression.
So then do we think there's any chance that, and this is probably, you know, a long shot or whatever, but like, do we think there's any chance that Kane is really like has become a true believer for the New Republic, and that's why she's like wiping his mind at the end? Or okay, no. Okay. No. Okay. All right. So here's my question then. Is it that the Empire and Gideon and Thrawn and Palpatine and whoever it is she works for and is working with, is it that they already have this cloning research and knowledge and ability, and they just don't want it to fall into the hands of the Republic as well, and that's why they're wiping his mind like that? Is that the conclusion we're coming to?
I think it's two things. Like, I think, like, obviously, like, he's on their radar as being someone who, like, really knows their stuff when it comes to cloning. I think they already, like, they still have remnants of the tech. I don't know if it's been, like, addressed in the Bad Batch or something. But, like, the remnants of, like, the Kamino tech and processes and brain trust there. But I also think, like, her mission was like twofold, and one was like, yeah, we got to get this dude busted and like gone, because like we need to like gatekeep this tech and stuff. But also, like, before we do that, let's figure out like what someone who's really brilliant about this stuff, like what would they put in their travel bag to do this stuff, like,
okay,
really effectively and in like, you know, a compact space and that sort of thing.
Or potentially too, I don't know, like, could it have been partially to prove that the amnesty program doesn't work, that you can't rehabilitate the Empire? You know, would that be part of their goal? Like, do they want to destroy this amnesty program? Or I don't know if that ultimately does anything for them or helps their goals anyways, you know what I mean? But there could be an element to that too, potentially. I don't know.
Could be, but I think like everyone in the New Republic side seems like pretty pleased with themselves the end of the episode. Okay. And they're like, yes, this is working. Like, this ain't the Empire, son.
And if she wants to keep, you know, working from within as a double agent, I mean, they're just going to have that much more faith in her at this point too, right? Because she helped root out one of the non-converts, you know what I mean? She's a convert, yeah. Ryan. She has proven she's a convert, and I mean, she's so converted, she's going to expose anybody who's not, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Okay. A couple other things. I have two other little things here, that I wanted to talk about from this section, and, jump in with anything else you wanted to touch on. But there's a moment where Pershing and, G-68 have to jump from one train to another, or they had to do it multiple times, but I was just thinking, like, this is a leap of faith, you know, in this episode called The Convert, in which, you know, Pershing has to figure out where he stands and Bo-Katan has to figure out where she stands, whatever. Like, he's asked to actually make like a leap of faith, and he does it. And I feel like the episode to a certain extent is ending on Bo-Katan being in a similar situation. You know, we don't really see her response, but like, it would be a leap of faith to kind of join the Children of the Watch, you know? And so anyway, I thought that was interesting. Maybe there's no connection to Bo-Katan, but I certainly felt like him having to jump from one train to another. It felt like, look, we're asking you, man, to make this leap of faith. Obviously he's not rewarded for taking that leap of faith in the end of the episode, but I thought that was kind of cool. And even cooler than that, when he is deciding, you know, am I going to continue my research? Like, she's saying, like, look, we can get a lab for you. You can continue your research, etc. Like, I swear, I didn't have time to like compare them side by side or anything. And maybe other people have already done this, I don't know. But I swear, the like chanting sort of like soundtrack stuff from, like, you know, the Squid Lake scene in Revenge of the Sith, like when Palpatine is talking to Anakin about all that stuff, and like you're seeing the sperm and the egg and all that stuff in the opera.
So
like
good.
There's so this like good. Like this yeah. ominous like chanting stuff, and I swear they brought that into the soundtrack in
what?
That moment when he was deciding. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Oh my god. I will lose it.
Yeah. So I think that
true.
I think so. Damn. I don't know. I haven't seen anybody else bring it up, but I think so. And then I do just want to say too, like I loved the Dean Cundey cameo. I was watching it on Wednesday morning at like 5 a.m. or whatever, and I was like as soon as I saw him, I was like, bro, that's Dean Cundey. It's gotta be. And then like when the episode was over, it was like, oh, it's cinematographer Dean Cundey, and I was like, for sure that's him. But they didn't list him in the credits, so I immediately like, you know, I took my iPod and did the like screenshot thing yeah. of him, and then like found a picture of Dean Cundey, and I was like, oh yeah, for sure that's him. So I thought that was really cool. And then I did not pick up on this stuff at all, but today actually David W. Collins tweeted that he felt like it was a, because I referred to Dean Cundey as a cinematography magician who is now a Coruscant, you know, street magician. And he was like, oh, it's like a reference to the old ILM magician logo thing. And that blew my mind because yeah. I didn't think of that at all, but I'm sure that's probably what it is. And then he reveals like a little dinosaur too, which he's the cinematographer on Jurassic Park, and of course ILM did the effects for Jurassic Park. So
yeah.
great observations from David W. Collins there, no surprise. Yeah. But
see, that's the those are the kind of like little references that I can like get behind.
Oh, you mean you like that more than R5?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yes, exactly.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
All right, so did you have anything else on the Pershing storyline?
Yeah, I think like, you know, you brought up the train sequence, and I think like the train sequence may be kind of like the shakiest sequence in the episode for me. It does feel like one of those things that's like referencing genre fiction in the past, like the we're on the train, they're coming around for tickets, like we don't have one because we're not supposed to be here. And here's the second video game reference. There's a very similar scene in Final Fantasy VII
where the characters
are on a train, and it's like one train car at a time is like getting locked down, and they have to like keep moving to the next one. And you know, I'm sure it happens in like a ton of other, you know, stories as well, but like that's the one that immediately came to mind. And I think like also that's like when they got to like the shipyard, like it kind of had like a Final Fantasy VII type feel, like a Midgar type feel. In that game, there's like a train graveyard that they go to, and it was like similar vibes to this. And I don't know, just an interesting thing to see. But like, I wasn't like when like the ticket checking droids like began, I didn't really feel a sense of like high tension, or maybe as high as like I should have felt, because it was also like, what would really happen if, like, I mean, I guess they like kind of talked about like, hey, we'll be going out of our jurisdiction, but like that feels like a oh, you don't have a ticket, well, either like you have to get off at the next stop, or like oh, we're gonna tell. And then like that doesn't seem like a huge threat, really. And so I don't know. I didn't feel like a huge amount of tension. And then like our friend Kevin like pointed out like the jump at the end where they land on like all like the padding like exactly in front of the ship that they were supposed to go on, like felt like a little cheesy, for sure. But it's not like an episode ruining thing. But if that felt like the weakest part of the episode to me.
Yeah, it's a convenience of storytelling for sure, that like the exact moment they have to jump off of the train to like, you know, because they came to the end of the line, you know, they land right in front of the Star Destroyer that they're trying to get to. But, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't bother me. Like, I certainly recognize it as a plot contrivance, but it's like, yeah, what do I want to do? Spend like 5 minutes with them looking for it? You know what I mean? Like, that's where we need to be at that point anyways. You know what I mean? So it's fine, I thought. But yeah, from a logical perspective, it didn't make a lot of sense. Or I shouldn't say it didn't make a lot of sense. It was just very convenient, you know? So, yeah. Yeah. And I guess one more thing we didn't talk about from that section is that, you know, another example of I don't know if dehumanizing would be the right way to put it, but the amnesty program, the people in the amnesty program, they have like a meeting. I don't know if it's weekly or monthly or what, with like their, you know, kind of, I don't, you could call it a counselor, a therapist, or you could call it like a probation officer or whatever it is, but they don't even have a person doing that. You know, they have a droid doing that. And so,
yeah,
it's like, how are you feeling? How are things going for you? Is there anything you'd like, you know, to change? And you're just talking to a droid. And obviously droids are given, you know, a lot of respect in Star Wars in a lot of ways. And, you know, there are some very lifelike droid characters, but I think the intention there was to be like, you know, we're just going to automate somebody to talk to you instead of talking to you ourselves. So, that was another touch that I think, was thoughtful.
Yeah. And then, kind of last thing on that, and I'm intending to use this word correctly, not the way dipshits use it on Twitter. But very Orwellian, in the 1984, sense of like the droid asking, like, do you harbor any ill will to your coworkers? Do you harbor any ill will to the New Republic? Do you have any negative feelings about the New Republic? Like, you need to tell us if you do. And I don't know, like, we don't know what the consequence of that is, but like, we know, like, the intent of a question like that is like, you're still on board with us, right? Like, we can, yeah, like, you're still swearing fealty to this, you know, government, correct?
Yeah.
Just making sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's talk about the final kind of section here where Bo and Grogu and Din return to the Children of the Watch. Paz Vizsla is like, whoa, what are you guys doing here? I think, but, you know, once Din proves that, yes, we did, you know, cleanse ourselves in the living waters, we are redeemed. You know, they're allowed back into the coven or the group there, the cult, whatever it may be. You know, she does test them or test that water. She pours it into the thing and she's like, oh yeah, nope, this is the legit water of the Mines of Mandalore. I'm not sure how that works, but it's cool. And so
we have this cauldron over here in our cave.
Yeah. So, but you know, I guess, the armorer and the rest of the Children of the Watch, you know, they certainly do seem in that case to genuinely believe in the kind of the rules and the structure of their brand of Mandalorianism, because, you know, they put their money where their mouth is, you know, like, this is a guy that they kicked out, but he's like, I did the thing I'm supposed to do. I can prove it. And they're like, okay, you're back in, you know, we accept you. So
kind of a baby face turn for them in a way, like, especially when, you know, kind of the same with, like, you know, the way we're feeling about Bo-Katan for, like, you know, from the previews and stuff. It's like, are these, you know, are these going to be antagonists? Like what's going to happen when, you know, Din goes back? Are they going to be like, no, like, we don't care. Like,
yeah,
whatever. You're an apostate. But no, they're like, yeah, okay, you did it. That's okay. Thank you. And then, like, all right, now let's, and like, your friend here, like, her too, like, and then we're gonna just slap everyone on the shoulders and like, yeah, you're here, you also can leave at any time, it's up to you, you're not like being kept here, like, if you want to do this with us, like, welcome.
Well, that line didn't creep me out in the show, but the way you just said it gave me creepy vibes. So you're like, you can leave anytime you want to. Like, trust me, bro. You know what I mean? That sounds a little suspicious, actually, the way you put it. But
maybe, but like they went like full baby face, like at the end there, though, like compared to like the standoffish nature, you know, from, you know, season one on, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that's really interesting, right? Because it's like, okay, well, number one, it ends with Bo, like, this is what they say to Bo-Katan. Then I was raised Catholic, right? Then they're basically walking around doing a peace be with you, you know, a sign of peace to you, you know what I mean? Like, as the episode ends. But then she looks at the wall and sees the Mythosaur emblem there and like, looks at it for a while. And it's like, okay, like, man, you know, like I think I believe in this Mandalore stuff again. You know, I think I believe in this, in the power of the way. And, you know, obviously she never was like exactly looking at it from their perspective, but I think that's the takeaway, right? It's like, okay, yeah, like this Mandalore stuff is pretty important to me, and here's an opportunity for me to like go all in on my Mandalorianism, right? Like I can like re-up my Mandalorian card by joining this group. So I think she's really thinking about it, right? Considering it.
Yeah, I think considering it. I don't think like she makes like a definitive, like she doesn't go like full Din here.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
But like, yeah, it like it creates this kind of you know, this dilemma, this kind of like a more complex examination of like the found family theme that permeates through like all of Star Wars. Like it's a, like, I don't really know how this is going to go, and which is just like a very interesting place to be.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, I'm thinking, especially after this episode, that there does seem to be a looming threat on the horizon. And so it's going to be important for any Mandalorian still left to put aside their differences and work together. So I think it makes sense on that level. I would say overall, I don't think that Bo-Katan will be a true believer in the very specific brand of Mandalorianism of the Children of the Watch. But, you know, perhaps she spends some time with them. Perhaps they learn to trust each other a little bit. And then when she's like, this whole leaving your helmet on stuff all the time is not for me, guys, but that doesn't mean we have to like be enemies of one another. I could see it kind of going that direction too.
Yeah. I like, it would be kind of weird if like the major takeaway of like this entire show is like dogmatic religion functions are the best.
That would be like, weird. Yes. Yes.
So yes. I would, you know, I truly hope that like they can just like, you know, coexist and, you know, find common ground, but like also like, you know, leave space for their, you know, own individuality and beliefs and stuff. Cause like I was saying like a week or 2 weeks ago or whatever, like I don't like, I know people think it would be like super cool and badass to have like a bunch of Mandalorians like fighting each other, but like I don't like, that's not really what I want from this show. Like, I don't want to see them just, like, flying around on jetpacks and, like, shooting missiles and, like, punching each other and stuff. Like, I don't want it to be, like, Captain America Civil War, where you're like, well, obviously they're going to resolve this, so this is just, like, indulgent and masturbatory just to see, like, a bunch of badass action, which is, like, what superhero comics and movies do all the time. And, like, obviously there's this like bigger threat, like, and this thing. So like, just don't even do that. Like, so this made me like very hopeful that like they're going to take a more like nuanced approach to the story.
Yeah. 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 And who really wins in a situation like that? You know what I mean? Like, whether it's the Children of the Watch that win or some other, but I mean, even within the confines of the story, like, you know, when you have the Mandalorians, you know, battling each other, it's like, until what? Until somebody wins and then the other ones are subservient to them, and like that's the victory. Like, you know, especially in an episode that's like about how one, you know, one system of oppression just ends up getting replaced with another system of oppression. Like, you know, if there ultimately is some Mandalorian civil war on screen in this show, it's just going to be like one brand of Mandalorianism like expressing its dominance over the other in the end, and like what's the value in that? You know what I mean? So yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to see that either. I would much rather watch a story about disparate groups that come together to battle a threat to everybody, you know? So, which is certainly more of a Star Wars-esque story, I think. Right.
Yeah. To like actually have like that story told in like a slow burn, like I feel like would be really satisfying. In a way that like Star Wars doesn't always quite like pull off, like the forces coming together. But I think like here, like there is enough like nuance and like you build this like in building of like empathy for these different like viewpoints. I was not like super excited about this season of this show. And, after the past two episodes, especially this one, like I am like so on board and so excited for like where this story is going in a way that I haven't really been since, season one, to be honest.
What a great way to bookend our episode, just like this episode was bookended, Ryan, because you just looked in that
convert.
Camera. You are a convert. You just said it. I'm a convert. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't hurt that like I just, I have this saw this article with this picture of Jon Favreau in a suit standing in front of this like graffiti mural that says Punk's not dead with Mandalorian helmets on it
with a can of spray paint in his hand. You know, he just got done doing the mural.
Good stuff.
It has been really great so far. So yeah. All right, cool. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here, Ryan, if that's cool with you. Okay.
Yeah, we got an episode coming from Carl Weathers.
We do. That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And what's it? The Foundling? Is that what it's called?
The Foundling.
The Foundling. Yeah, so that's promising as well. I believe we talked about this earlier, but certainly that could be indicative of some good Grogu story development in the next episode. But I think also Bo-Katan, like she, to me, I feel like she is in some ways a foundling at the end of this episode, right? They have, because what does it mean to be a foundling? Like you're rescued, you're brought into the fold, you're made part of the group, you know what I mean? And that's what the armorer said to her at the end of this episode, right? We're gonna take you in, So I think that's compelling. And then there's always, opportunity for other characters maybe to fit that mold too. Cause I certainly, if you would have told me before this episode aired that it was called The Convert, I think you could have given me about a million tries and I never would have been like, I bet it's about Dr. Pershing. You know what I mean? I would not have.
And the New Republic amnesty program.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Existed.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, Carl Weathers, episodes have been great so far, the ones he's directed. And, the show is really, as you said a minute ago, the show is really working for us right now. So I think, it's all looking good for next week.
Yeah. And one last thing just kind of about that episode, I think pretty much like the last two pieces of footage I can remember from the trailers are the Mandalorians dropping out of like the drop ship, like parachuting in or jetpacking in. But then also that footage of those Dan Jedis.
The flashback. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So.
Yeah. And the drop ship stuff, I think, was over Navarro. And if this is a Greef Karga. Like, I mean, I would imagine Greef Karga's in the episode if Carl Weathers is directing. So it would make sense for them to be back on Navarro as well in the upcoming episode. So, yeah.
See?
A lot to look forward to. All right, cool. Yeah. So until then, we're gonna wrap up here. You can find all of the previous shows we've done at blockaderunnerpodcast.com. If you want to share your thoughts on the episode, you can email us, blockaderunnerpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter, @BlockadeRun, or and message us there. Ryan, you're on Twitter at
Via Malay, VYAMALAY, and Standard Definition Gaming, DefStan 480.
All right, cool. And we do have a Discord that we've gotten up and running in the last few weeks. So a link to join that Discord will be in the show notes here. And so anybody who's listening who would be interested in having some ongoing Star Wars conversation with some really cool and friendly people, that's a great place to do it. So we encourage you to jump in on the Discord as well. All right. So until next week, thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Blockade Runner podcast.